thanks for being here today. I'm Scott Schiff with the Atlas Society, and we're very pleased to have Atlas Society Senior Fellow Rob Trzynski talking about getting lost in Model Land. After Rob's opening remarks, we'll take questions from you. So if you want to request to speak, we'll try to get to as many of you as possible. Rob, intriguing topic. Let's hear about Model Land.
Okay, so thanks, Scott. This is part of the work I'm doing on an upcoming book looking at Ayn Rand's whole philosophy, but especially also looking at her epistemology, her theory of knowledge, her theory of, how do we look out at the world and observe and gain an understanding of the world. By the way, I just wanted to check before we get started. I've been doing these in a new room of the house we just renovated, and last time it was really bouncy because there was no furniture in here. So how is it doing today? Is it better?
Yeah, there's a slight echo, but I think it sounds good. Okay.
Yeah, when we get the carpet in here, it'll be better. There's a rug coming in here, it'll get better. I just wanted to make sure it wasn't too bouncy for the talk here. No, all right, so anyway, that's just the housekeeping stuff. All right, so talking about Ayn Rand's theory of knowledge. And one of the things I want to contrast it to is one that I think is very common, very widely accepted, and has certain negative consequences in terms of a way that people look at how you gain knowledge of the world. And it's one that sort of throws people off. And the best way to summarize this up is that it is a theory of that in understanding the world, what we do is we make mental models of the world. So the idea is that abstract knowledge of theoretical knowledge about the world, scientific knowledge about the world, philosophical knowledge about the world, that these are all quote unquote mental models of the world. And so what we're doing, we're trying to figure out whether our model is valid or true, is we're trying to compare the model to the data from the real world. Now, this is part of a wider idea called representationalism that I'm going to get around to. But it's the idea that the most sort of common and in some ways the most extreme version of this I came across is from the 20th century philosopher of science, Karl Popper. Now, he's probably the most well-known. I think he's the most, he's the most popular philosopher of science among actual scientists because, and I think for valid reasons, which is that, there's a sense that a lot of the 20th century philosophers of science were out to sort of take science down a peg. They were out there to say, oh, science doesn't have this special claim to knowledge. It's no more valuable than anything else. It's no more valid than storytelling. And there's, I think Thomas Kuhn is one of the people I like to use as my example on this, where there's this idea that, scientific knowledge is just this consensus, this paradigm that you form by social consensus. And it's really no more valid than any other form of knowledge. And so there's this sense among philosophers of science, there's been a certain trend of what I think, it almost seems to be motivated by a kind of jealousy. It's like, here we are, we humanities people, we've been out here arguing back and forth with each other and spinning theories and never really getting anywhere and never actually getting to the truth. And then here the scientists come along, and in a couple hundred years, they put a man on the moon, and, they've outdone us so badly that, we feel like we have to, there's a sort of resentment of they've outdone us so badly. We have to take them down a peg somehow, show that, well, no, this is really just an illusion. They haven't actually done anything better or different than the humanities people. So that, Thomas Kuhn, who I like to beat up on, has this whole weird section in the Structure of Scientific Revolutions, his main book, where he tries to take on this idea of, well, why, but science put a man on the moon. Doesn't that show they've done something? He said, they've created some knowledge, some techniques that are better for one particular goal, but maybe not better for other goals. And he tries to subjectivize the whole thing and sort of make it, try to wriggle out of this idea that, well, putting a man on the moon is kind of proof that you have gained valid knowledge. All right, so in contrast to that, Karl Popper, I think, is liked by actual scientists because he seems like he's trying to create, an objective standard by which scientific knowledge can be created, that you can test it against data. Now he says you can't prove something actually true. You can falsify it, But, you know, there's a sense of like he's trying to capture and trying to preserve or celebrate the science, you know, what's happening in science rather than tearing it down. So that's why I think Popper is so influential. But this idea of the mental model, this is very central to Popper's idea. And I think this is where people pick up this particular sort of distortion of how to think about the world. All right, so let me talk about what Karl Popper's most extreme version of this. In 1967, I came across this. In 1967, he gave a lecture presenting a theory of the three worlds. I call this third world epistemology, with some implications there. Anyway, he had this theory of the three worlds. And just briefly summarize this. And this is that there are three worlds we all live in. So world one is just the world, the real world of actual things. Or yeah, the real world out there, if you want to call it that. World two is a world of mental entities that consists of the sort of the perceptual or experiential level of consciousness. So every time I have, you know, I have contact with the world, I have perceptions, I have, you know, images and things like that that pop into my mind, images that correspond in some way to the things out in the world. And so that's its own sort of mental world of images and perceptions that forms inside my brain. And then he says there's a third world. And on the basis of observing this world too, you have this sort of internal process of observing the world too, the world of mental entities, of perceptions inside your brain. So there's like a little faculty inside of you that observes those mental entities inside your head, the world too. And on that basis, you construct world three, which is a conceptual level theoretical model or reconstruction of world two. And so this is kind of a mind-bending idea, and I haven't seen it used very often explicitly, but I think it's implicit in a lot of what Karl Popper is doing, a lot of what he put out into the world. So if we could to visualize, give you visuals to sort of work on this, to understand this. The way I would describe world one, you know, world one is a billiard ball. So I came up with these examples, by the way, in talking about causality, where, you know, billiard balls as examples of causality have been used since at least the time of David Hume. So the actual billiard ball in reality is the world one. World two would be an image of a billiard ball in your head. And then, so, you know, sort of, I use a photo with my video. So it's like a two-dimensional projection or image in your memory of what a billiard ball looks like. So that's world two. World two is composed of those things, all these images in your consciousness. And then world three would be, you know, picture a schematic diagram of a sphere, right? So it would be the image of the billiard ball, but shorn of all the details, stripped of all, you know, specific aspects of color and what, you know, maybe there's an eight, it's an eight ball, so there's it's black with a white center and the eight written on it. All that stuff is taken out, and you've reduced it to sort of a framework diagram or schematic, right? And that's, you know, you have the equator and you have the radius of the sphere, and you've reduced it to the mental entity of a theoretical sphere. So that's sort of an idea of what he's getting at with this world one, world two, world three. And this is the idea that conceptual knowledge, abstract knowledge of the world, is some sort of schematic model built in your head that is supposed to correspond in some way or be able to predict what's going on in world two, which is then connected in some mysterious way to the real world, right? And it's always not always clear how it's connected to the real world. All right, so, and this is very much how Popper thinks science is done. It's just that, well, you go around, you create these mental schematics, these mental models. And it's more like these mental models are sort of like a laboratory where you create these mental models, you use the mental models to deductively create predictions about what's going to happen in world two, the world of your perception. And then you judge your models by whether or not, how well they produce the predictions for the data that appears in world two. So you'll notice one thing about this is very, you know, abstract theoretical knowledge is very, very, in this view, very disconnected from the real world. I like to use the phrase the real world out there, because that's, you know, how people think about it, right? It's like you are stuck here in your brain and the real world is maybe somewhere out there. And if you find yourself, by the way, my advice is you find yourself using the phrase the real world out there, you really have to rethink your assumptions, because the real world is not the out there. You are in the real world, right? You are in and surrounded by it and impinged upon it and connected to it in a million different ways. But if you find yourself thinking about the phrase, the real world out there, you've already accepted this sort of inverted idea of what consciousness and how the brain works and how we get knowledge of the world. But that's very much what Popper has done. He's the real world is world one. It's not even the world you're in. It's a totally different world. The world you're in is this world of images. And then on the basis of images inside your mind, and then the images inside your mind produce another world that's like even more inward, even more isolated inside your head, which is this world of abstract schematics that somehow are that you hope will correspond or accurately predict the results of the world of mental images. And again, you're getting at a greater remove from the world each time. Now, a lot of this is reflecting a longstanding idea in consciousness. I think it's the one thing people get most wrong about understanding how knowledge works and how perception works. And it's called representationalism. And this is the idea that, you know, when you observe the world, or when you encounter or the world impinges upon you, however you want to put it, that what happens is that a set of images is created inside your brain that are sort of representations of the world, and that you're not perceiving the world directly. You're perceiving these representations of the world that are recreated as images in your brain, right? So the way I would think about it is the schematic I use, that this is not a visual medium here, so I have to describe it. The schematic I use is of, you know, there's the world out there, and then there's your head. And then inside your head, there's like a little TV screen. And on that little TV screen is a bunch of images that represent that are supposedly what's going on out in the world outside of you. And your consciousness is this other little head, this other little guy inside your brain looking at that TV screen. Now, I just realized that I'm trying to sort of struggle to describe these mental images. I don't need to work so hard at it anymore, because some of this has actually been put into fiction or into the films. So think of the Matrix, right? So this is sort of the Matrix view of the world. The idea that, you know, we're brains in the vat and we're being shown this sort of simulated images. And you're literally looking at a television screen that represents, inside your head, that represents what the world is. All right, so think of it that way. All right, so then the thing about this idea of consciousness as creating mental models of the world, and that's how we understand the world, that's what abstract or theoretical knowledge consists of, it is that you'd have to think about, so I had there's the real world out there, you have then inside your head, there's a little screen showing images, and then you have another little guy, another consciousness inside there looking at those images inside your head. You'd have to nest that another level. So the theoretical level, the conceptual level, the level of abstract thinking would be another little screen inside that smaller head and another little guy looking at that, right? This very strangely nested thing. And of course, you know, if you think about it, if you take that really seriously, you'd have to, you know, well, how is that little consciousness inside the consciousness inside the consciousness? How is that perceiving anything? Well, there has to be another little consciousness inside him. And it would be this infinite regress, and you'd be getting farther away from reality each time. So that gives us an idea of what the problem with this approach is, this idea that all we have are mental models that we can sort of vaguely compare, and we can project the data and see if the predictions line up with our perceptions, that this is getting us off the track of how consciousness actually works. Now, I want to talk about what I think the answer to that is, how consciousness actually does work in relation to that. But one of the things, so it's a book I've been checking out, and I haven't gotten very far in it, but I like the approach of it. It's called Lost Escape from Model Land. And it's published recently, and it's making the case that people get too caught up, scientists especially get too caught up in their models, and that they don't realize that the model is not the real world. The model is just a way of simulating or trying to capture, trying to understand something about the real world, but it is not, the model is not the end goal. The world is the end goal. You know, the world is the real world is the standard. And you can see people getting lost in these models in a number of different ways. There's an old saying, the map is not the territory, right? And this is, I think, captures the idea that you have the map. If you have a map is a schematic, it's a world three kind of thing. It's a mental diagram representing the world out there. But there's a difference between the map is simplified. It is generalized. It leaves a lot of stuff out. It's not the same thing as actually being in the territory, walking around, seeing the concrete things you see out there. So one example I want to point out to this is, because I think it's one that where this intrudes into our political debates and our larger cultural and social debates, is the idea of is this idea of global warming. Right, so how is it we know that global warming is going to happen, that it's going to become catastrophic, that it's supposedly going to have all these horrible results? Well, primarily the big evidence brought up for it is models. People have created climate models, computer models of the climate that are supposed to project what's going to happen with the climate 100 years into the future. And the fact that you can create these models, you can churn out these models, and they produce certain results, is taken as evidence of, oh, we know this is going to be catastrophic. But this is almost entirely done, especially in our political debate. The scientists, some of the real scientists who are doing this are much better about this. But when this filters into the political debate, where people have this obvious interest in hyping the thing, obvious political interest, you know, it serves some goal that they want politically, there is this tendency to drop the difference between reality and the model. And to refuse to acknowledge the limitations of a model, the fact that it is simplified, and I think in some of these cases oversimplified, the fact that the climate of the entire planet over a period of 100 years is phenomenally complex, and so to make a computer model of it, even a very complex computer model, you are radically simplifying it and making all sorts of assumptions. And those assumptions can influence, you know, you have assumptions about what's the responsiveness of the atmosphere in terms of, you know, how much extra greenhouse gases will produce how much warming. Well, we don't actually know the answer to that. So you have to make assumptions about what that responsiveness is. And those assumptions, you know, when you put them into a computer model and you turn it around, they can get amplified and produce all these results. So you actually have this tremendous amount of difference between the different models. And then you have the observed results, which, you know, to this point, generally fall below that of the, at or below that of the lowest results from the models. So you have a clear issue here where there's a difference between reality and the models. The map is not the territory. But you have this outlook of, no, we created these models, therefore this is, you know, really solid knowledge and this is science, we should all act on it immediately, instead of waiting to see how the models turn out, how accurate they turn out to be. Now, by the way, I want to say that, you know, a model per se is a useful tool epistemologically, but it's a useful tool so long as you remember that it is a model, that it is simplified, that it is, and there are reasons to simplify something, to create a model of it. And some of the reasons are that you have, let's say you have imperfect knowledge of all the exact details. So you have to create a simplified model because you can't create something more complex, but you're creating a simplified model to see what that model will tell you so you can ask better questions and make better observations. You know what to look for to see if you're on the right track or the wrong track, right? But then you'd have to be very careful to make sure that you remember your simplified model is missing data or missing something. Or there could be cases where you know the reality is more complex, you can measure it, and you actually know how to account for the greater complexity of the real world compared to the model. But for to make the computation simpler, you realize that, well, if I leave out some of the complications, I will still get a result that's good enough for the purposes I'm using for. You know, it'll be within the tolerance of accuracy that I need, and it'll make the computation simpler. So I do a model. And so there are all sorts of reasons why you would want to use models in a valid way, but they all have to take into account the fact that the model is not the same thing as the reality, and that you know what you're putting in and what you're leaving out of the model. You know what your assumptions are. And so you know that this is an abstraction that is simplified and taking away and has somehow taken away from the details. Now, to get to what I think is the right view of conceptual knowledge. Now, this is whether you can use models validly within this right view. So it's not so much that models per se are invalid, but to contrast it to what full knowledge of something is, as opposed to the model, which is sort of a simplified or artificial version of the more complex knowledge that you get from observing reality directly. So just to indicate what that would mean. So this is the key, one of the key things in Ayn Rand's, in the objectivist epistemology, and Ayn Rand's view of the nature of conceptual knowledge, is that her idea was, so this all goes back to actually this view of models. I mean, I talked about Karl Popper, but where it ultimately goes back to is there was a theory of concepts that was very common in the Enlightenment era that was like, it was, the best way to describe it is that it has a sort of schematic approach to conceptual knowledge, that in creating a concept, you know, if I have a concept of man, I call it the stick figure theory of concepts. So if I have a concept of what a human being is, a concept of man, what I would do is I would abstract away, create this sort of schematic of, you know, it's because some men are taller and some are shorter, some are fatter and some are thinner, some are, you know, they have different color skin, they have all these different characteristics. So you simply drop out and ignore all those other characteristics. Those characteristics are irrelevant. And then you reduce the concept down to a sort of schematic. You know, so I talked about the billiard ball, and then you have the image of the billiard ball, then you have this sort of schematic of a geometric schematic of a sphere. Right, you do the same thing for human being. You come to this sort of schematic stick figure version of what a human being is, which is, you know, stripped of all specific characteristics and just this sort of abstract schematic, and that's what the concept is. And Ayn Rand was arguing against that viewpoint. Her viewpoint is that when you form a generalization, so a concept like man or furniture or chair, what you're doing is you're taking all the observations you have, all the things you observed, the specific examples you've seen of it, and you're not getting rid of the specific details. What you're doing is you are finding some real similarity. You have to find some real genuine, objective, directly observable similarity among these things. You're focusing on that similarity and using it to group all those things together into the members of a class or a group. You know, all these different creatures are men, they're human beings, as opposed to dogs, cats, other animals, inanimate objects, etc. So what you're doing is taking this group of things that exist out in the real world, you're observing them in the real world, and then you're taking those real world observations and you are taking a certain perspective on them. You're saying, well, I can view these things, mentally view these things as all members of a class of similar things, because of certain directly observable similarities they have. But in doing that, at least to form a proper concept, a concept that's really grounded in the facts of reality, you're not dropping out and sort of carving away all the specific details. You are focusing on certain things that are similarities among them, but you're keeping all the details, because ultimately the concept is just that group of things out in the real world looked at from a certain perspective, from a certain mental perspective, right? So it's similar to how, if you're looking out, you say, let's look for all red things. You know, you say you're looking at a giant crowd of people. You say, I want to look at everybody who's wearing a red coat, right? You can mentally sort of look out and give your brain the command, I want to observe everybody who's wearing a red coat. And then you'll see this like dots of red all throughout. And that's in your mind, what you're doing is you're still looking at the crowd. They're the same people, the same crowd. You're not ignoring anything. You're not missing anything. You're not carving out real facts about this. But by looking at the crowd in that way of saying, I'm going to focus specifically on Red Coast, you'll see ... There they all are. You're seeing those things as a group from a certain perspective. And that's sort of a certain mental perspective. And that's what she's getting at in her theory of concepts. And what it does is it takes this world one, world two, world three approach that we were talking about. And it collapses it all back down. So you still just have one world, right? The world of things out there. And your consciousness is in contact with and observing that world. And then when you make abstractions, you are then observing that world from a certain specific mental perspective that allows you to see the thing. You're still observing the same world. You're seeing it in a slightly different way. You're getting different things out of it because you're observing it from a perspective, but you're not observing something different. You're not creating a new world or a new class of mental entities that you're then observing. You're creating the same old world one, right? So there's just one world. We don't have to create a second one and a third one in order to account for perceptual knowledge or for abstract and conceptual knowledge. And so if we keep that in mind, then you could create a model, but a model is just a tool for helping you better understand what questions to ask about the real world that you're actually observing. All right, so that's a long, complex and description, but I wanted to sort of take that on because of, I think, this idea of abstract knowledge, and theoretical knowledge of the world consisting of model making about the world, tends to turn people inward to this sort of mental world and to creating ever more abstract and complex models and sort of living in the world of models inside their head and not focusing on the question of how do you connect your abstract knowledge to the actual, you know, perceptually observable, you know, directly encountered facts of the real world. All right, so I think now would be a good time to stop for questions, comments, other examples people can have of how they've encountered this sort of model making approach to thinking.
Great. And if you want to participate, just click request to speak. In the meantime, even with global warming, I mean, you were assuming, you know, I think some being mistaken, but what about, you know, where there are these kind of agenda-driven data scientists that start with a hypothesis and try to tweak the data to match it?
Well, do you have a specific in mind or just in general?
Today? I mean, even with like climate change, they can, you know, they talked about that in Climate Gate. They're like, massage the data until it reads what you want.
If you torture the data, it will confess. that's actually a saying, you know, the sort of sardonic saying among scientists, because, you know, they know that the danger there is that you could. Yeah. And then that's the thing is that I even encountered, there's an objectivist philosopher or historian who was doing this once. This is years ago, and I'm not going to go into the details, but he said he had this approach of, well, I have this theory. And so I went and started looking for facts from history that fit the theory. And I thought, well, there's your problem. You started with the theory and you went looking for facts to fit it, right? And that's sort of it was the problem, I thought, with the way he approached the thing. I think it's the occupational hazard of intellectual types, right? There's a problem with intellectuals is they're interested in ideas, right? As opposed to being interested in the facts to which the ideas are supposed to refer. And so we can get so enamored of the theories of models we have in our head that we start with that and we build palaces of theory inside our head and then we go looking for facts to support it. And obviously, if you go looking for facts to support a theory, you're probably going to find some, right? If that's all you're looking for, if you're giving your brain, let's look for facts that support my theory, you're probably going to find some. As opposed to saying, let's look at all the facts and then, you know, see what theory emerges from that. Instead of looking at all the facts and seeing, you know, is this perspective I have on the facts, is it one that's viable? Is it one that works? Or is it one that, you know, I can fit a few facts into it, but the whole pattern of reality doesn't match it. And I would also say, I think this is, I one of the reasons I mentioned this is there is, and I'm one reason I mentioned it specifically on Twitter Spaces, is I think that there is kind of a Silicon Valley tech bro kind of attitude that comes out in this, which is, because, you know, if you're a tech guy and you're used to writing code and computer software, you kind of want all, you know, it's if writing code and computer models and creating computer software is what you're good at, you kind of want all the world to be code, right? you kind of want everything to be solvable by, if I just write code and input it, I can make the world, you know, do what I want it to do. I think this, actually, you know, there was a fad for a while, and I think it's still around there, of this sort of pickup artist kind of lingo about relationships and, you know, this very mechanistic model of how romantic relationships work and how to get a woman and how to have a relationship with a woman. And it's very much in this sort of mechanistic mode of, well, you input certain data and that you game the system in a certain way and you get a certain result coming back out. And I think this same thing sort of tends to spread in the tech bro kind of culture that you often see on Twitter. because again, it's, you know, if you're really good at manipulating code, you're really hoping the whole world will just be a matter of manipulating code. And you also see it, I think there's a, Scott Alexander is a guy who does, he used to do a Slate Star Codex, I think it's Astro Codex 10 is the new version of it. It's a Substack blog he has. And he has some really interesting observations to make sometimes. But I get really kind of frustrated with him other times because he tends to be very satisfied with this very, let's construct a mental model of the world and then make deductions from that mental model as a way of thinking about the world. And oftentimes when I'm sitting there saying, you know, thinking, you can just go observe the world directly and see how things work. And it's actually much easier to understand things if you do it that way, as opposed to, to constructing this very complex mental model and trying to deduce from that. So it is a common and widespread attitude or approach.
Great. We want to encourage people to join us with questions. We have our founder, David Kelly. Welcome.
Hey, Scott. Hey, Rob. Fascinating talk to me as an epistemologist, especially. I have a question. You know, a lot of what you said, I totally agree with about model building. And it's, you know, the realm in which I've seen it at its worst is economics, where people, you know, devise all these economic models and then expect, you know, this complex, incredibly complex economy to conform or predict. I'm not an economist, so I can't judge them particularly, but I just think, you know, it's an exercise in a lot of a priori thought. But I do have a question. When we are acquiring knowledge, we start with what we can observe and we form concepts for observable things. But, you know, we progress a long way and the concepts become more and more complex and more dependent on previous concepts. And so do our theories and observations. And so, in addition to the standards of evidence for a given conclusion, there's also the standard of integration and consistency with the rest of what we know, which could be thought of when you get into complex areas of science as a kind of systematic view anyway. I don't know if I agree that it's called a model, but I think that's what at least some philosophers of science are getting at with that when they use that term. Anyway, does that fit with your conception? That's the question.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting thing. I think the systematic thing doesn't necessarily mean a model, though, because what it means is that when you're integrating something into a whole system of other knowledge you have, you're integrating it with other knowledge you have, other things that are based that you've other observations you've made and the results of those observations. You know, so. I'm trying to, there's a way of describing that. I think where it becomes a problem is when you have a very narrow specialty, right? And then you're integrating it with things from other specialties where you don't have access to all the observations, right? So you don't have you're assuming that the knowledge produced in that other field, often validly assuming that the people working there have figured something out that's correct, but you don't have full firsthand knowledge of what it is. So as you get to the fringes of your own sort of specialized knowledge, you sometimes are acting on a simplified model, you know, taken from somebody else's work, where you don't have access to all the data or all the observations, all the complex knowledge, you know, because the world is limited. You are limited. You're one person. Your lifetime is limited. You can't become an expert in quantum physics and biology necessarily at the same time. So, you sometimes are taking things in a simplified model form where you don't have all the direct knowledge. And yet the two fields do need to be integrated. You have to somehow connect what you're doing with what's going on in that other field. And I think that leads to, possibly to unavoidable problems where you are connecting it to something you don't fully understand. And, there might be, and I've seen specialties arise in the connections between fields, right? Because there is a need for somebody who will actually understand both sides and try to figure out how they go together without messing up either one.
Yeah.
And I think that what you're speaking to more widely, and the reason why model making and the model view, I think, really arises, is because at a certain level, yes, we do get to more abstract knowledge where we've gone from what can be observed directly. So if I'm classifying furniture, chairs, tables, armoire, whatever, really complex, bookcase. I'm looking around the room here, trying to classify things. Desk. If I'm classifying furniture, it's all based on stuff I can just observe and look at directly. If I'm classifying subatomic particles, right? I'm not talking about something I can observe directly. Now there are things I can observe directly, right? There are experiments you can do when you get visible results. Based on those visible results, you are inferring something that's happening on a micro scale that you can't observe directly. And so when you get to that point where you are describing things that are either too big, the structure of the galaxy, or too small for you to observe directly, it's easy to fall back on, you kind of need a mental model. You need to use models that are simplified versions. So a great example of this is the old one of, what is an atom like? Well, you have a nucleus. I mean, there's a protons and neutrons in the middle, and there's these little, then you visualize these little like billiard balls sticking together in the middle. And then, circling around them, orbiting around them, sort of like planets, are the electrons. And this is the common, it's probably learned this in school, the common model for what the atom looks like. Yeah. And then of course people come along and they say, oh, well, now we've got new knowledge from quantum physics and the Higgs boson and whatever else. And we know that's not really true. That's an overly simplified model. And people use that to say, see, therefore we've overthrown previous knowledge. Well, no, you've overthrown the previous oversimplified model. You haven't overthrown the actual body of observations and connections and theories that referred to. So, again, if you take the model too seriously and make the model your goal rather than the facts and observations that it refers to and that the model is sort of trying to gather together and help you understand, then you can get to this idea that, well, if I have a simplified visual model I created of something that's not visual, and then that model turns out to be wrong, you can think, oh, I overthrew, this overturns all existing knowledge. The old paradigm, as Thomas Kuhn would say, has been demolished. Well, what you've overthrown is the simplified tool that you created to help you visualize this,
right?
But not the actual knowledge and the actual observations. That's my soapbox on that.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks. That sounds great, Rob. Appreciate it.
Great. So, are concepts to a degree a representation of reality?
Well, see, it's the representation that I'm arguing with. So concepts are I think the radical heart of Ayn Rand's work on epistemology, and especially her theory of concepts, her view of what abstractions are, is that abstractions are not a representation of reality. So representation means reality is out there, and then I'm creating something new that represents it, right? So if I were creating a representation of the death of Julius Caesar, right? You know, this is, I go up and perform a Shakespeare play, and it's a bunch of guys. It's not Julius Caesar being stabbed by Brutus. It's a bunch of guys on a stage pretending to be Julius Caesar and imagining what he might have looked like and what people might have said. And, you know, speaking the immortal lines of Shakespeare, it sounds like a good way to do that. But that's not Julius Caesar, right? So that's a representation. And that's what we're not doing with the concept of the valid concept. If you really understand something, you are not taking reality and representing it in some artificial form. Her radical heart, the radical heart of Ayn Rand's epistemology is that an abstraction, a concept, is a perspective on the real world. So you are directly observing the real things, but then you are taking a certain mental perspective. Like, you know, like I think of that analogy, I came up with it just now, but I like it better than what I've come up with before, which is this idea of looking at, you have a, imagine a massive crowd of people, tens of thousands of people, all wearing different colored clothes and coats and hats and what have you. And you say, I'm gonna look at this and ask who's wearing a red coat. And then you can see how you get this mental perspective. You're looking at the same crowd, nothing's changed, nothing's represented, nothing, you're not taking all the people in red coats and pulling them out into a separate area. You're looking at the exact same crowd. But if you say, just look for the red coats, you can focus and see them as a pattern, as a thing jumping out from, you know, mentally isolated out. Now they're mentally isolated, but they're not actually isolated, right? So you have this perspective on the crowd where you look at it from the perspective of who's wearing a red coat, but nothing about the crowd itself has actually changed. So that's why it's not a representation, it's a perspective. Now, looking for people in red coats is probably not an exceptionally useful category, right?
Well, you can think about things that aren't there. And I guess, you know, the other thing, it's just that when you omit the measurements, as Rand said, it becomes different than that thing in front of you necessarily.
So that's the thing, is I think some people take, and that's like a misinterpretation of what her theory of concepts is. So she said, what you do is you omit these, you know, the people have all different measurements. You know, some people are taller, some people are shorter. So you form the concept of man, you omit the measurements. What she means by omit the measurements is not that they are actually removed, right? It's not that they are consigned and stripped out mentally. And that's, I think, the key misinterpretation. I don't think that's what she's saying. And I think when people interpret it that way, they get to this sort of older idea that the stick figure view of a concept, right? So you're stripping out all the individual measurements and you're just ending up with this stick figure schematic. What she means by omitting it is you are mentally, it's not central to your perspective, right? You are selectively focusing on something else other than the specific measurements. So it might be the shared characteristic, right? You're focusing on this fact that they share a certain characteristic and not focusing, sort of putting less, de-emphasizing. So de-emphasizing might be a better word. De-emphasizing the differences in that particular characteristic. So everybody has some height, right? You know, we're not disembodied, non-spatial beings. Everybody has some height, but what exact height you are, well, it doesn't matter. We're going to de-emphasize that mentally. But you're mentally de-emphasizing it doesn't mean stripping it out and getting rid of it and turning and reducing everything down to a schematic. And that's, I think, the real heart of what I'm getting at with this idea of not viewing things as a schematic or a model of reality. That conceptual knowledge ideally is reality. Conceptual knowledge is reality observed by you directly with you using a certain mental perspective to emphasize one characteristic for a certain purpose you have at this point and de-emphasize other characteristics that don't matter for your current purposes. And then at another time, you'll emphasize a different characteristic. But it's what you're observing is reality from a certain perspective. Your changes in mental emphasis change your perspective on those real facts.
How about, speaking of these models, you know, Musk and other people say that it's at least possible we're living in a simulation. I mean, even if the belief is likely wrong, some of these models don't necessarily stop a person from being creative.
Oh, certainly, certainly. You know, well, a model, the same thing with a model or a thought experiment. Or, you know, a thought experiment in a way is a contradiction. It's a weird oxymoron. It's a contradiction in terms. Like, you know, if you are just sitting around in your head thinking, you are doing the opposite of an experiment, right? A real experiment is you do something in reality and see the result. And of course, the key difference there is when you do something in reality and see the result, you know that it's reality creating the result and not you just imagining it, right? So it's very easy when people do quote unquote thought experiments, that the basic problem or the basic pitfall of the thought, the danger of a thought experiment is that everything's coming out of your own mind, out of your own thoughts. So so what you're doing is you're really relying on all the existing knowledge you already have about the things that you're thinking about, and you're projecting from that existing knowledge, but you don't have new knowledge or new facts that you're gaining about it. So it really allows you to sort of project what you already think and then say, oh, I did a thought experiment. Nevertheless, thought experiments can be useful. I mean, I just came up with one. Suppose you're looking at a crowd and you look at all the people with red coats. That's a thought experiment, right? So that I came up with that. I didn't actually go look at a crowd and do that. I imagined myself looking at a crowd. But now when you do that, though, you're creating this sort of projection, this imagination of what would happen if. And you have to be confident, or at least you have to be willing to test whether you're really right about that. Now, in terms of, you know, what if I were looking at a crowd and I looked for only people in red coats? That's something that's so close to everyday experience that I think, you know, you have a high degree of confidence. I would even put it to a certainty that I can project what it would be like to do that. I can imagine doing that because I've done similar things. So here's a great, let me pluck a real world example out of this, which is one that always struck me. There was a guy, I think it was Radek Sikorski, who's a figure in the Polish government, a high ranking politician in Poland. But he talked about, I remember once him recounting when he was a young man, is at the end, the last years of Soviet rule or of communist rule in Poland. And John Paul II, Pope John Paul II, came to Poland very famously in 1980. He was the Polish Pope. He came back to his homeland. And the communists poo-pooed him because, of course, they were officially atheists. So they were like, oh, only a few old ladies will turn out. Nobody really cares about the Pope. It doesn't really matter. And, of course, what happened is massive, enormous crowds turned out for the Pope. You know, millions and millions of people, like 2 million people, turned out to see him. This incredible sea of humanity, you know, coming to see the Pope. And Sikorski talks about climbing up in a tree and looking and seeing this vast, you know, we get this higher perspective, seeing this vast crowd. And then off of the edges in nervous little clusters here and there were the secure services, you know, the secret police, the guys who were supposed to be doing the crowd control. And he suddenly had this realization. He said, there are so few of them and so many of us. And it's this perspective change he had, that a realizing of how few people there were actually enforcing this communist regime, as opposed to the number of people who really didn't believe in the communist regime and didn't support it and who would abandon it in the moment if they thought they could get away, if they weren't afraid. And it was just like this evaporation of fear that comes with realizing how many of us there are and how few of them. All right, so there's an example of somebody, a real life example of somebody looking out at a crowd, doing a selective mental focus. How many of these people are ordinary people who came to see the Pope? How many of these people are security services who are here to enforce, you know, the will of the regime? And then, you know, getting a real, you know, a profound result from that change in mental perspective. So there's a real life example of, you know, you're not looking for people with red coats. You're looking for people with, you know, with uniforms and other things that mark them as members of the regime. And you're getting this real profound information as a result of that. So that's, I think, a real plucking from the real world, somebody's real world recollections, an example.
Very good. There's still time if you have a question. I've still got more. Three world epistemology. I mean, how much of that is Plato's duality with the third layer?
Well, I think it's absolutely it's an echo of Plato. So the difference, now the difference, and what makes Popper is better than Plato, and I think scientists like him better than Plato, for this reason, which is that, you know, the Greek philosopher Plato had the idea that, you know, there's the real world. There's your perceptions, these sort of fleeting, imperfect perceptions we have of the real world. And then there's our conceptions, which refer to another world, a world of pure forms. And this is, again, the world of abstractions that's separate from the real world. And that is very much, you know, Popper's idea of this sort of, I call it third world epistemology, is because I like to contrast it to first world. You know, ours is first world epistemology. It's the better epistemology. It's wealthier and more luxurious, etc. But this third world epistemology is definitely an echo of that Platonic approach, that there's a realm of abstractions that's different from, it's a whole different world, disconnected from the realm of observation, the realm of real things in this world. And the difference, now the difference in what makes Popper slightly better, is that he doesn't actually think that the third world has a sort of independent, he doesn't think it comes first. You know, so in Plato's idea that the realm of abstractions is so much better, it's so much neater, it's so much more perfect. You know, and this is, I talked to you about the occupational hazard of the intellectual, is we're fascinated with ideas. And so the problem is that ideas can become so interesting to you, they're more interesting than reality. And Plato's the perfect example of the guy who took this all the way, right? The world's abstractions is so much neater, so much purer, that schematic in my mind, that geometric schematic of a sphere, it's so much more perfect and purer than any actual round thing I've ever seen in the real world. And so therefore it must be superior and better. It's the real world. That's the world that really exists. And everything else, you know, is the world we live in is just this imperfect reflection of it. Right? That is the Platonic view of the world, the ancient Greek view of the ancient Greek philosopher Plato. That's his view of the world in a nutshell. All right. So, and the problem with that is, you know, your problems with that are myriad, right? Because you then ignore the real world. And what's better about Popper is he kind of concedes a sort of a more Aristotelian approach, whereas like, no, the real, you know, Aristotle was Plato's student, but he reversed the whole thing. He said, no, the world of objects is what exists, and abstractions are all just taken from that. They're based on that, and they refer back to it. And so the abstractions are not more real than the concretes. The concretes are the reality, and the abstractions have to be based on that in some way or reflect it in some way. Now, he wasn't, you know, he had some elements of representationalism in his view, but that was much more his approach. And Popper sort of concedes that, right? But he then has this idea of, well, mentally what's going on is you're making these, you're creating this mental world of models that then has to be compared back to the facts of the world. And like I said, that, you know, it's less damaging because he has the idea, no, you have to compare it back to the world. The real world, you know, the real world is your ultimate standard of sort of experimentally, factually, what happens. What happens when you create an experiment and you get an actual result? That's the standard. But in his idea of how you create the abstractions, it's the idea you create them by going farther and farther away from the facts. And I think that creates a lot of pitfalls in terms of how people think. So it sort of produces this leftover echo of Plato within an Aristotelian, you know, world-focused viewpoint.
You've found a valid sense to use the world out there when it's to one of those intellectuals that's stuck in the world of ideas.
Yeah.
How about the idea that J.P., Jordan Peterson and others talk about, the heuristic model of learning that we learn through stories?
Yes.
Is that a useful model?
I'm not an expert on that. I think he's right that we learn through stories. He's wrong, I think, from what I know. Again, I'm not a Jordan Peterson expert. I've become less inclined to become one because of the things he said recently that, I don't know, especially things about Ukraine that indicate he's not thinking very clearly. But what I would say is there's an old idea that people think through stories. And actually, I'm going to recommend my favorite, you know, I got to do this, Scott. I'm going to recommend one of my favorite Star Trek episodes. This is Darmok from the fifth season of Star Trek: The Next Generation, where they encounter alien species. The whole point is it's a total high concept thing. But the whole point is, you know, I imagine them pitching this to the studio executives, right? Okay, so we're in this show where the whole idea is that they're trying to communicate with a guy and they can't understand a single word he's saying, And half the episode is going to be Picard and this guy talking together where you can't understand a single thing the alien is saying, right? So it's this, like, how do you sell that? They could only sell that in the fifth season after the thing was such a runaway hit. They were just saying, do whatever you like. All right, so, but the idea is that they come across this alien race that where you know, they have this universal translator, so it's automatically translate everything that people say. And the universal translator doesn't work. It can't figure out how to translate their language. And it turns out that they all speak in metaphor. They all speak in stories and images and stories. So they say things like Darmok Anjalad at Tanagra. And, you know, it refers to a story about a character named Darmok and a character named Jalad in this place called Tanagra and what happened to the characters there. And that's their way of communicating something, or they say, Yarai and Jiri at the crossroads. And there's two characters and there was, you know, something that happened at a crossroads where they met. And you're supposed to understand what's happening because you understand the story. And of course, if you don't know the stories, if you don't have the folklore behind it, it's going to be incomprehensible to you, which is why the translator won't work. Well, this is a real way that people think. And I wrote a whole article once about how a lot of our politics works this way. So a lot of our politics is the bridge at Selma, you know, so, and, you know, this is where or Washington at Valley Forge. And, you know, we're referring to these stories and these narratives. But the problem you see in our politics is, of course, you know, the problem with thinking in terms of stories and learning through stories is it can be valuable. Stories are helpful. I just told you a story about this guy from this Polish politician, I think Radek Sikorski is his name, who climbed a tree and saw, you know, the crowd. I told you a story and you learned something from it, right? The problem is that when the narrative becomes, again, it's the same problem with models. It's when the narrative becomes the central focus and not the facts that it's steering you to. So, you know, the narrative or a model or a narrative or a story can be useful as a way of steering you to certain facts, but then you have to then go all the way and go to the facts. And, you know, there's a longstanding complaint about what's called narrative journalism, right? Originally narrative journalism referred to the idea of you don't just report a dry series of facts, you tell it as if it were a story. But then narrative journalism can also become, and I've seen it practiced on both the left and the right, it can become, you come up with the story first, you like the story works, it feels satisfying to you, it suits your political purposes or your biases or, you know, what you want to stampede people into, and then you fit the facts into the story. So you come up with the story first and the facts later. And so again, it's this thing of, you know, if you have this idea of models or narratives as the central thing of cognition, rather than just as tools to get you to a more exact and literal description of facts and grasp of facts, you're going to go off the rails, and you're going to have, you know, what we often get in the press of people who have a preferred narrative that they want it to fit, and then everything. And I don't want to pick one side of the debate because it's done liberally on both sides. But the one that jumps to my mind is there's a Twitter feed called Died Suddenly. And it's a bunch of anti-vaccine and, you know, COVID people, people who are anti-vaccine. And so the whole purpose of this Twitter feed is anytime somebody who seems young and healthy dies suddenly, they report it, like, you know, and of course they report that, oh, he was vaccinated. And the idea is supposed to be, therefore, can't you see it? It's the vaccine that killed him. And the ghoulish thing about it is if you actually look at, you know, if you actually follow the stories and look up what's, you know, they report these things and somebody died suddenly, they do it without looking into any of the medical history, having any knowledge of what actually killed the person. And if you can get information on somebody, so they've had these cases where people followed this up, what's the real information? It turns out, well, the guy was a major drug addict, right? He basically had a spoon up his nose all the time. And he didn't die suddenly. He died of a drug overdose because he was a drug addict. Or, you know, he died suddenly, but it turns out they did the autopsy and he had a congenital heart defect. And so the guy was 32 years old and seemingly very healthy, but he'd been living his whole life with something that was going to kill him at any moment. He just didn't know it. So again, this is a case of somebody taking a narrative that they like. The vaccines are killing people, and then scanning the world for facts to shove into that narrative. So that's the problem with, you know, so learning through stories is very valuable. We all do it. I've done it in this last hour. But again, you have to always keep in mind, it's just a way of getting you to a perspective on the facts that is based on literal, verifiable facts, and not taking the story first or the model first and fitting the facts to and choosing, cherry picking the facts to fit it.
Great. Well, that takes us to the bottom of the hour. It was a great discussion, Rob. We look forward to the completed project. And thanks to everyone who participated. If you enjoyed this or any of our other materials, please consider making a tax-deductible donation at atlassociety.org. Thanks for joining. We'll see you next week.